Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson, here with Steve Rendell. This week on Counterspin, even if you don't drive much or at all, crude oil at $70 a barrel means higher prices on things like home heating, plastics, jet fuel, increased transportation costs, and increased costs to consumers. Like some Congress members, media outlets appear to be in high dudgeon about gas prices, but do their explanations for the situation make sense? We'll hear from Tyson Slocum, director of Public Citizens Energy Program. Also on the show, since taking office, George W. Bush has been defying Congress and the Constitution by quietly issuing signing statements after signing bills. In these statements, Bush spells out provisions in the bills that he will not honor. We'll speak to the Boston Globe's Charlie Savage, whose reporting, with little help from other journalists, has resulted in congressional hearings into the practice. That's coming up, but first, as usual, we'll take a look back at recent press.
A May 3rd New York Times report on labor conditions in Jordan shed some light on the rampant abuse of workers in the country's garment industry. The scale of the abuse was, according to sweatshop opponent Charlie Kernahan, the worst he'd ever seen, which is saying quite a lot. To that end, the Times story was a welcome corrective to the globalization cheerleading you more often see in the media, not to mention the Times' own op-ed page, thanks to the presence of Tom Friedman and Nicholas Kristof. But that's not to say that the Times story was problem-free. Start with the headline, "An Ugly Side of Free Trade, Sweatshops in Jordan." The point seems to be that the horrible treatment of workers, many of whom are guest workers from China and Bangladesh, is an unexpected or unusual phenomenon. The Times conveyed as much in the article, reporting that, quote, "The abusive conditions that guest workers described show how hard it is to control sweatshops as factories spring up in new places, often without effective monitoring in place," close quote. Well, some would say that the lack of monitoring has been a key reason why corporations choose such locations for their factories to spring up in the first place. And mammoth corporations like Target and Walmart, which sell the garments made in Jordan, are well known for putting pressure on suppliers to drive down costs at every opportunity. If paying workers a decent wage and ensuring humane conditions was something they wanted to do, they'd go ahead and do it. An ugly side of free trade? Without question, but also a familiar and predictable one.
CBS's Bob Schieffer began his April 30th commentary on Face the Nation by fondly recalling an old friend, Daniel "Chappie" James. "He was an African-American," Schieffer told viewers, "and part of a Vietnam fighter pilot duo that were called Black Man and Robin." Schieffer's point was that his friend would have been pleased with Face the Nation's guest list that day, which just happened to be all female, because it matched his feeling that, quote, "there would never be full equality until we no longer noticed that someone was the first or the only," close quote. It's true that the women weren't the first to ever appear on the show, but that's not much of a boast. The White House Project's latest study found only 18% of Face the Nation's guests were women, not very close to full equality, and Schieffer's friend, being African-American, wouldn't have seen many people like himself on the show either. The National Urban League's 2005 study found just 5% of the show's interviews were with black guests. Schieffer did insert a cop-out in the midst of his self-congratulation, noting that Face the Nation doesn't invite guests, quote, "because of race and gender. We invite key players in the week's big stories," close quote, as if key players and big stories were platonic forms that media have no role in defining. Of course, some might see Schieffer's timing in hauling out fond tales of his old black buddy as somehow related to pending charges of racial bias against Schieffer and CBS. According to a complaint filed by a 13-year veteran of the network, Schieffer addressed a veteran African-American correspondent, "Hey Boy," and he, quote, "frequently and publicly refers to a newsroom assistant as Brownie due to the complexion of his skin," close quote. The complaint also notes that not a single African-American CBS employee holds a rank above producer.
On April 30th, NBC's Meet the Press devoted its entire hour to rising gas prices. Host Tim Russert's panel included Secretary of Energy Samuel Bodeman, Democratic Senator Dick Durbin of Illinois, Red Cavaney, the president and CEO of the American Petroleum Institute, Daniel Yergin, who runs a corporate energy group and is on the board of advisors of the Energy Department, and CNBC host and investment advisor Jim Cramer. Not included, in other words, were experts from consumer or environmental groups or alternative energy advocates. Critical commentary was left to insider Durbin, who argued that the White House panders to oil companies and doesn't properly invest in sustainable energy alternatives. A real public interest representative could have taken that argument beyond partisan lines. As it was, the discussion did little to explain how, for example, ExxonMobil, a company with a record $36 billion in profits last year, could get away with offering a retiring CEO a $400 million compensation package while continuing to get tax breaks from the government. A recent report from Public Citizen noted that oil companies have contributed over $50 million in campaign contributions since 2001, with about $40 million of that amount going to the Republican Party. A broader discussion might have asked how that relates to industry-friendly legislation or questioned the popular line that waiving environmental regulations is a viable response. Russert did, however, offer an apology for some of the perspectives that were not part of the conversation. Quote, "Our viewers should know we did invite the representatives of the major oil companies, Shell, Chevron, BP, ExxonMobil, Sunoco, and ConocoPhillips, to be with us today. They declined. We hope they will join us in the future." Close quote.
The April 27th Wall Street Journal included a disturbing page one story about what the paper called a broad effort by the Pentagon to gather intelligence within U.S. borders. The moves include monitoring activists' emails and the National Security Agency's, quote, wiretapping of calls without a warrant between people in the U.S. and suspected terrorists overseas, close quote. The story referred to a Wall Street Journal NBC News poll in which 52% of respondents said they supported those wiretaps and 46% opposed, and they called this illustration of, quote, a surge of popular support after the 9/11 attacks for more vigilant efforts to prevent terrorism, close quote. The problem is, the poll the reporters cite reflects support only for monitoring suspected terrorist communications. Other polls, more relevant to broad domestic intelligence efforts, actually display a growing public awareness of the distinction between being guarded against terrorism and having one's civil liberties eroded. ABC Washington Post surveys since the fall of 2003 found respondents agreeing that the United States government is doing enough to protect the rights of American citizens, dropping from 69 to 46%, while those saying not enough is being done nearly doubled, from 28 to 51%. And Village Voice columnist Nat Hentoff cites a Zogby poll from February, which found that many Americans across party lines were unwilling to surrender civil liberties, even if it is to prevent terrorists from carrying out attacks. Even routine security measures like random searches of bags, purses, and other packages were opposed by 50% of respondents, with just 28% willing to allow their telephone conversations to be monitored. It would be distressing if Americans were overwhelmingly supportive of predations on their civil rights. But what does it mean that the press corps seems so eager to portray them that way?
Finally, Stephen Colbert of Comedy Central's satiric Colbert Rapport certainly shook things up at the annual White House Correspondents' Dinner on April 29th. In his trademark right-wing Bill O'Reilly-like persona, Colbert skewered George Bush and the press, ironically congratulating journalists for covering for Bush on tax cuts, WMD, and global warming, and alternately chiding them for deviant reports about secret prisons and domestic spying. At one point, Colbert offered this advice to the Beltway journalist in attendance.
Let's review the rules. Here's how it works. The president makes decisions. He's the decider. The press secretary announces those decisions, and you people of the press type those decisions down. Make, announce, type. Just put them through a spell check and go home. Get to know your family again. Make love to your wife. Write that novel you got kicking around in your head. You know, the one about the intrepid Washington reporter with the courage to stand up to the administration? You know, fiction.
The performance was initially ignored by journalists. A New York Times report on the event didn't even mention Colbert. But following wide exposure on C-SPAN and various websites, they began to take notice. The consensus was that Colbert was inappropriate. He was too tough on Bush, and he just wasn't funny. The Washington Post's Richard Cohen said Colbert was a failure as a comedian and rude. Others said he went too easy on journalists at the expense of the White House, but that was clearly untrue. More likely, what bothered journalists was Colbert's departure from the shared fantasy that prevails at these events, where everyone pretends the White House and the press are on different sides. It's understandable that Beltway journalists, stung by Colbert's barbs, would pan his performance. But why should anyone take them seriously when they pretend to deliver disinterested assessments of Colbert's comedic talents?
Thank you, Steve. You are listening to Counterspin. Counterspin is brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group Fair. Big oil shouldn't be blamed, ran one newspaper column's headline. Supply and demand, not politicians, make gas prices go, was another, while a third piece warned that capitalism has become a dirty word. It would seem that there's already a growing backlash against efforts to call someone to account for escalating gas prices. Questions in Congress about the coincidence of higher prices with record oil industry profits were described by U.S. News and World Report as politicians, quote, desperate to show that they feel the citizenry's pain at the gas pump, battling to don the mantle of Robin Hood, close quote. But while media can certainly be counted on to track what the magazine calls the political peril of the issue, how are they doing at the more fundamental job of explaining the causes of and possible responses to the present situation? Here to help us out with that is Tyson Slocum. He's director of Public Citizens Energy Program. Welcome back to Counterspin, Tyson Slocum.
Oh, happy to be here.
Well, a very basic line from the U.S. oil industry, we see it throughout the media discussion, is essentially, you don't understand, this is an international market, oil companies don't set these prices, and anyway, compared with other industries, we're not really making that much money. Could you give us, lay people, your response to that?
Well, first of all, to address the PR campaign by the oil industry, where they are trying to convince us that they're not really making that much money compared to other industries, that's totally false. And all you have to do is pick up a copy of ExxonMobil's annual report that they give to investors. In that report, they don't talk about their profits as a share of sales, which is the way the company describes its small profit margins when it's talking to the general public and to lawmakers. Rather, when ExxonMobil and other oil companies are talking to investors and to Wall Street, they use a very different methodology to calculate their profitability, and that is profits as a share of capital investment. And when that measurement is used, a company like ExxonMobil made a 46% rate of return on its U.S. oil operations in 2005, a 59% profit margin on its U.S. oil refining. So clearly, this $36 billion that ExxonMobil made in profits last year is not only a huge number, but it's also based upon a huge profit margin. It costs ExxonMobil about $20 to extract a barrel of oil, whether that's in Nigeria, Alaska, or Texas, or wherever. They're then turning around and selling that to the U.S. market at more than $70 a barrel. So any oil producer, whether you're the Saudi royal family or you're ExxonMobil, you're making a killing, about $50 profit on every barrel of oil that you produce.
Well, it's confusing for media consumers because while we're being told that this is economics 101, we also hear that we're at an 8-year high in terms of supply. Now, I know we can't get into too much detail here, but the reason that you can have high profits when there's no shortage has to do with how oil prices are set, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Oil prices are not set by OPEC or by the Saudi royal family. They are set every day on energy trading exchanges in New York and elsewhere. Those energy traders are increasingly unregulated. A company called Enron lobbied very hard back in the year 2000 to pass a law called the Commodity Futures Modernization Act.
I've heard of them, Enron.
Yes. Well, what this act that Congress passed back in 2000 did was it heavily deregulated these electricity and natural gas and crude oil exchanges, meaning that now about half of the trades that occur that set the price of crude oil are going on totally unregulated, meaning the federal government has no opportunity to monitor the activities of the hedge funds, the investment banks, and the oil companies that dominate these exchanges. So really, the price of crude oil, I think, is being driven more by speculation and profit-taking than based on true supply and demand situations.
Well, another common media theme has been that the political posturing is just that, because really there's nothing that can be done to lower prices. USA Today on May 3rd rounded up what they called a gusher of bad ideas, and they included a windfall profits tax. They called that a way to, quote, satisfy people's urge to vent their anger at oil companies, close quote, and they say that it was tried in the 1980s and it didn't work. Now, I know that Public Citizen supports such a tax, so how do you answer that?
The windfall profits tax of 1980 was enacted in the wake of skyrocketing oil prices after the Iranian Revolution of 1979. As prices skyrocketed around the world because of the global oil shortage, a lot of U.S. oil producers and U.S. oil companies got very rich. So Congress enacted this windfall profits tax, and shortly after its enactment, the global market started to settle down. And so when the price of something that you're taxing goes down dramatically in value, the effectiveness of that tax is going to be limited. And so that's what happened, and that tax is eventually repealed. The difference today is really nobody is talking about the bottom falling out from oil prices. We've got a situation where new sources of oil production are becoming increasingly scarce, and demand continues to increase. And so there's going to be an upward pressure on prices. And as long as that happens, these oil companies are going to continue enjoying record profits. And all that's doing is sending a signal to oil companies to drill for more oil. What we need to do is to implement a windfall profits tax that would capture a portion of those record profits and invest it in things that are actually going to solve America's energy crisis, like alternative fuels, like renewable energy, like energy efficiency, and bigger investments into mass transit. In addition, we also need to significantly increase fuel economy standards. We haven't increased them in 20 years. As a result, the average car and truck on the road today gets about 21 miles a gallon. In 1988, it got 22.1 miles a gallon. We're getting worse fuel mileage today than we were in 1988. That's an embarrassment.
Thank you very much. We've been speaking with Tyson Slocum. He's director of Public Citizen's Energy Program. You can find them on the web at www.citizen.org. Thanks for joining us today on Counterspin.
It was my pleasure.
George W. Bush may have taken an oath to uphold the U.S. Constitution, but the Senate Judiciary Committee is holding hearings now to look into whether Bush is defying Congress and the Constitution by claiming the right to ignore some provisions in laws that he has signed. Hundreds of times during his tenure, following the signing of a bill, Bush has quietly issued signing statements asserting his right to defy certain provisions in some of the legislation. There is little doubt that the hearings would not be happening if not for Boston Globe reporter Charlie Savage, who has reported extensively on Bush's profligate use of these signing statements since last December. Charlie Savage joins us now by phone from Washington, D.C. Charlie Savage, welcome to Counterspin.
Thanks for having me on.
Tell us how George Bush has been using these signing statements.
When President Bush signs a bill, he sometimes issues a signing statement that gets quietly filed in the federal record without any fanfare. A signing statement is not a proclamation in which a president says, "I'm very glad that I've signed this bill. It's going to help us. Good job, Congress." He often issues those as well. But a signing statement is a technical legal document, which is essentially his interpretation of the bill and instructions to the federal bureaucracy or the military or whoever is going to be implementing it about what kind of policy they should devise when they go to put this new law into force. President Bush, more than any president before in U.S. history, has used signing statements to declare that he can ignore provisions of new laws that he thinks conflict with his interpretation of the Constitution. He's done this more than 750 times since taking office 5 years ago, by far a record for any U.S. president.
How does that pan out in terms of percentage?
Well, it's a little complicated. He's attached signing statements to about 1 in 10 of the bills that he's signed, but some of the bills are massive omnibus 100,000-page bills full of new laws in which he's challenged, in some cases, more than 100. In other bills, of course, are simply one-paragraph statements that say Arbor Day is neat, and he would not have challenged one of those. So the figure 1 in 10 itself is not as illuminating as you might think.
Well, there's some issue areas that he's been using them in more than others, too. Tell us a little bit about that.
Overwhelmingly, the provisions that President Bush is challenging are provisions that he thinks restrict his own authority to run the government as he sees fit, because he's the head of the executive branch and the commander-in-chief of the military. He has a sweeping view of the powers that the Constitution give him to wield, a view that is not endorsed by mainstream legal scholars. And so he's using these signing statements to single out hundreds of provisions which regulate and set rules for how the military can be used, what kinds of information can be given to Congress, whistleblower provisions which allow executive branch employees to go to Congress if the government is doing something wrong without being fired or otherwise punished, safeguards against political interference by his appointees and federally funded research, as well as numerous rules and regulations for the military, most famously perhaps the torture ban and oversight provisions in the USA Patriot Act.
Give us the details. What did he say about that torture ban? Wasn't that the McCain bill?
That's right. As your listeners probably recall, late last year in Congress, there was a huge fight led by Senator John McCain to pass a bill that would make clear that U.S. interrogators cannot torture or otherwise use cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment against a detainee in their custody, no matter where in the world they are. Bush fought against that. He threatened to veto it, although he's never vetoed a single bill in his presidency, the first president in modern history not to do so, and these signing statements perhaps reveal why that is. Vice President Cheney went to the Hill and personally lobbied lawmakers not to pass the torture ban, but both chambers of Congress passed it overwhelmingly by such large margins that even if Bush had wanted to veto it and take the political heat for doing that, they would be able to override his veto. So Bush signed the law. He gave a press conference in which he accepted the torture ban and, in fact, tried to take credit for it, even though he'd been fighting against it. And then later in the day, he issued a signing statement saying that he was the commander-in-chief and no law could prevent him from authorizing harsh interrogation techniques if he decided that was necessary to help prevent terrorist attacks.
Well, is Bush using these signing statements differently than they've been previously used? Other presidents have used them. But in the past, haven't presidents used these to point out parts of the law that they thought were in conflict with Supreme Court precedent?
There is no doubt that previous presidents going way back in time have occasionally declared that they're not going to enforce a provision of law because they believe it's unconstitutional. And sometimes they've issued signing statements to that effect. And there's also no doubt that starting in the mid-80s, and including the Clinton administration, more signing statements were issued than had been issued before. What's different and unprecedented about what President Bush is doing falls into three levels. First of all, he's doing it much more frequently than any president before. He has crushed all previous records for the numbers of laws that he says he can disobey, and he has 3 years left in office. Secondly, he's making far more aggressive claims than most previous presidents. His views of his own powers to have absolute control over any executive branch employee in defiance of a statute by Congress that seeks to give some degree of independence to an executive branch employee is not supported by Supreme Court case law. Previous presidents did not, to my knowledge, issue signing statements that were making constitutional objections that were in conflict with Supreme Court case law. And third, he's doing this at the same time that he has not vetoed a single bill, which raises the prospect that the reason he is not vetoing a bill, the first president since Thomas Jefferson to go this long in office without vetoing a bill, is that these signing statements have become a substitute for vetoing a bill. They become an override-proof line-item veto by which he could knock out chunks of legislation that he doesn't like, keep the rest, and do so in a manner that neither the Congress nor the media has paid any attention to.
Well, as I mentioned, Charlie Savage, you've been on this story since December of 2005. How many other reporters are seriously looking into the signing statement story?
There has so far not been a great deal of interest in this story among the mainstream media, at least in the print mainstream media. There were a few stories in January that came out a day or a week after I first wrote about the torture ban. There was not, to my knowledge, any story that came out after I wrote about the Patriot Act signing statement in March. And so far there has not been any reaction to this week's piece, although Senator Spector announced during a committee hearing that he was going to have hearings in it. And today some Democrats introduced a resolution, or announced they were about to introduce a resolution in the House condemning the practice.
Do you have any sense why there's been so little interest? Can you tell us about conversations maybe you've had with other reporters that might give us some indication why they didn't seem to find this story as compelling as you have?
Well, I wouldn't characterize it that way. I've actually received compliments from fellow reporters. I think it's a fact of human nature in this business, and I'm no different than any other reporter, that no one likes to follow in anyone else's wake.
Do you have any idea where this story is going to go from here?
Well, we'll have to see what happens with these hearings that Spector holds. These could go either one of two ways. They could be simply legal experts talking to each other about conflicting legal theories, in which case they're unlikely to make much of an impact. Or it could be a genuine probe of exactly why the administration has adopted this legal strategy. How often are they actually making use of these waivers that they're claiming to have, which is something that's very difficult to know because so much of these laws involve national security and what the government is doing there is secret. If it's a genuine probe type of hearing, this could have legs.
We've been speaking with Boston Globe reporter Charlie Savage. You can read his stories about George Bush and signing statements online at the Boston Globe's website at www.boston.com. Charlie Savage, thanks for joining us today on Counterspin.
Thanks for having me.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by the staff and interns at FAIR, the Media Watch Group based in New York. The show is engineered by Bill Seary at Mercer Media. With me is Steve Rendell. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.